My father was a very, very popular and wonderful teacher, loved by faculty and students, honored at the university where he taught. And I watched him die slowly, painfully. He tried to hide it from me, but I could see he was suffering terribly. And it was an awful thing to watch. My father, whom I loved dearly, wasting away from an illness that seemed to be so arbitrary and unfair. I couldn't understand why somebody so kind, so good, so decent, could be subjected to so much pain and to the humiliation of being weak and sick and needing to be cared for by others. Until finally he found himself lying in a hospital bed, attached to all kinds of tubes and monitors and needles and catheters and life support systems. And then, early one morning, as dawn was breaking, as I gazed out the window of his hospital room, I saw a car accident. Two cars collided head-on at the intersection below. There was a screech of brakes and a horrible grinding crash. And one of the vehicles overturned with its tires spinning, and it burst into flames, while the other hit a lamppost. And there was blood all over the street, and one of the drivers had been thrust through the windshield and was lying on the hood of his car, while the other driver had been impaled on his steering column. Meanwhile, my father was coughing, pulling IVs out of his arms, when suddenly he fell out of his bed in a heap, writhing in agony. And I didn't know what to do, and I went running out into the hall to find his nurse. There seemed to be no one in the corridor or at the nurse's station, so I went into the next room where I found her, and she was astride a patient. She had her skirt pulled up, her undergarments on the floor, and she seemed to be writhing and rolling about. The bed was shaking, and they were so engrossed that neither of them noticed me when I burst into the room. Her eyes were closed tightly and she was panting. The guy was in traction, his head was bandaged, he had two casts on his arm and his right leg, and he was covered in sweat, and he seemed to be groaning. And then I heard the phone ringing in my father's room. So I rushed back and I lifted the receiver. It was my ex-wife, and I was surprised because I didn't know she even knew about my father, much less cared about him. And she said, "Now look here, I've waited long enough. It's been 3 months. I've had no money from you at all, and you know the terms of our divorce." And I said, "Wait, please, Darlene, my father is near death. I can't talk about this right now." And she said, "Fine, then you'll be talking to me in court." She slammed down the phone, and I turned back, and I kneeled down by my father, and I put my ear close to his mouth to feel if he was breathing, and I felt for a pulse. And then I said a short prayer. "God, if you can hear me, please help my father. He's been such a good man. He doesn't deserve to die in this graceless, horrible way. Please help him now. I have never asked for anything before from you." And having said the prayer, I took a deep breath, and for a moment my father's writhing stopped and he was quiet, and I thought that my prayer had been answered, when suddenly my father went rigid, then into convulsions, emitting a ghastly moan, and his face turned red and then gray, and he went limp, and I realized he was dead. A few days later, at the funeral, I was sitting next to my mother, who suddenly, in the middle of Rabbi Goldman's eulogy, rose from her chair, limped slowly, leaning on her cane over to the coffin, and started to cry uncontrollably, calling my father's name out, when her eyes suddenly rolled up and her hat with the veil fell off her head, and she dropped her handbag, which opened up, spilling vials of pills, which rolled along the floor. She reached inside the coffin as if to pull my father out, emitting a high-pitched scream. Then she trembled violently for a few seconds and collapsed. But before she died on the floor there in the funeral home, she looked up at me and she said, "No meaning, no escape, no relief, no hope." And then she muttered something in a language that I'd never heard her speak before, and she passed away. During the drive to the cemetery, my mother and father sharing the same coffin, there was a long entourage, a procession of at least 50 cars, and we all had our lights on. And a thunderstorm broke, and I was sitting in the hearse. It was also very hot, one of the hottest days of the year, and the air conditioning in the car had broken down, so I was bathed in sweat. And the driver, he looked like the devil. He was pale and thin, with a sort of head that looks like a death's head, very prominent teeth and jaws. And the rain was coming down heavily, and the windshield wipers didn't work very well, and it was hard to see. And then the road ahead was washed out, and so the whole cortege had to take a detour and go over another smaller bridge further down the river. And we got lost, and this trip to the cemetery became a nightmare that lasted for hours. We were consulting maps, stopping to ask directions, and then somebody got a flat tire, so the entire funeral cortege had to stop and wait while they fixed their tire. And the rain continued to pelt down. And then we drove over a rickety old broken-down bridge. And a minute later, I heard a cacophony of horns and cries behind me. And I stopped the car and I got out, and I realized the bridge had collapsed and the last six cars had fallen into the river 100 feet below. And we tried to save the members of the party, many of whom had already drowned. Uncles, aunts, friends, people who were colleagues of my father. I could see cars upside down floating down the river, while others had simply disappeared beneath the water. And there was one car hanging half on the bridge, half over the water. And someone was crying out from the interior of the vehicle. And the valley was flooded. Animals and people standing on the roofs of houses. And so we continued toward the cemetery to bury my mother and father. But when we got there, all of the graves had been flooded, and coffins were floating away, caught in the river's current, with decomposed bodies and skeletons hanging out of them in crumpled heaps. And I stood there in the mud, watching this scene of devastation. And then I saw a beautiful wood-frame church in the distance, with a steeple and a bell tower, surmounted by a crucifix. And suddenly, two giant bolts of lightning streaked down, and there was a monstrous explosion that blossomed up to the sky, and the church was enveloped in flames, and people were running from it, their bodies on fire, flailing about wildly. And just then, a traffic helicopter crashed into a mausoleum, and two small children, very shabbily dressed, covered in mud, two little blonde, blue-eyed girls, emerged from the underbrush where they'd been hiding. And when they saw me, they started to throw stones and branches at me, calling me a Jew bastard. And I just stood there, not even ducking, not even feeling the blows. And it was then that I came to the realization that the world is evil. People talk about the benign indifference of the universe, but it didn't seem so benign to me. The universe was, in fact, malignant. But then, I began at night to experience a recurring dream of what appeared to be an angel, a woman framed in light, who hovered above my bed, looking down at me sorrowfully, with an arm extended. And this dream was so profoundly real that when I woke up, I sat bolt upright in my bed, sweating. I felt that it really happened, that it was not a dream. And then, this female angel began to appear in my real life. I'd be walking down a street and suddenly in the reflection in a window, I'd see her face behind me. But when I turned around, she was gone. Or I'd be in a coffee shop and I'd see her in a booth across the room looking at me, and I'd blink and she'd disappear. And I'd see her down an aisle in a supermarket or in the lobby of a movie theater. Sometimes she'd appear as a mannequin in a store window. Or I'd see her in a television commercial flipping hamburgers and singing. But when I looked at her face, there were tears running down her cheeks as she stared at me from my TV set. Then I was in a movie theater once watching a trailer of an upcoming science fiction film, and in the corner I thought I saw her in the shadows of a huge alien spaceship. And then as she fled, that underneath the look of terror that she was affecting as an actress, she was really looking at me with that same look of sadness. And I saw her in photographs and magazines. And once, when I went fishing, I saw her face staring up at me through the water. And I saw her face on the surface of a full moon, her mouth moving in a silent prayer, a prayer for the dead. And I saw her face in skywriting that would slowly blow away, and in chalk drawings on sidewalks, and in the graffiti on buildings, and woven into the patterns of Persian rugs, and repeated in the grains of knotty pine tabletops. And so I became obsessed with this otherworldly creature who was not only appearing in my dreams, but everywhere in my life. She was so beautiful. Pale, thin, young, tall. She had a long cascade of almost white hair, an angular face, high cheekbones. She dressed in a sort of white gossamer gown, and she seemed to float through the air rather than walk. Her face had a look of passion and sadness. She seemed to be watching me with sorrow and empathy. But she never spoke. And she neither smiled nor frowned, but her eyes were full of emotion. I found myself thinking about her all the time, and sometimes I thought of her as the woman I'd been waiting for all my life. And I had the feeling that she could save me somehow, free me somehow. But whenever I tried to call out to her, to move toward her or to reach out to her, she'd disappear. Then, one evening, I went to a neighborhood restaurant for a small salad and mineral water. I was picking at the salad without enthusiasm, and the mineral water seemed flat and stale. And I was sort of in a daze when, out of the corner of my eye, I thought I saw her again. She was sitting very quietly, alone, at a table in the semi-darkness, in the back, drinking a glass of white wine, candlelight playing on her face. At first, her eyes were lowered, and then her gaze met mine. And I felt myself overcome by an emotion that I'd never felt. A combination of longing, passion, tenderness. I felt that, in that one moment, I could either begin to laugh hysterically or cry mournfully. didn't know why this was happening. And I had a sense that maybe I'd known her in another life. And then my eyes began to tear up, and I felt slightly faint. And then I found myself standing up, and I overturned my salad plate, and the sound of it shattering on the floor seemed very, very far away, as if it were coming from a great, great distance, and had nothing to do with what was going on now. And I found myself drawn to her table, walking as if in a dream. And I wondered if in fact this was a dream, and if I was really in bed and still sleeping. And so I walked toward her, and she looked up at me calmly. And I came to her table, and I managed somehow to ask if I could sit down. And she nodded. And I sat down next to her and stared at her, transfixed. And then I said, "Who are you?" So we spent the evening together. We went for a walk and took a ride in a horse-drawn carriage through the park, listened to jazz at a club, went to a local cabaret and heard some music and songs and improvisations, and then we went shopping at the local drugstore. She had a prescription she needed to be filled, and you know how it is, you have to wait a couple of minutes at least, and during that time we bought nasal spray, some Q-tips, hydrogen peroxide, insoles for my shoes, 9-volt batteries, 2 pints of bottled water, Tic Tacs, and emery boards. And then she got her prescription, which she immediately drank down with some water. She took 2 tablets. And it was a wonderful evening. We had a lovely time. And then she said she had to go, and I hailed a cab for her, and she got in, and she said, "Call me," and she was about to give me her phone number, but the cab drove away, and I stood there, pencil and pad in hand, in a daze, not knowing what to do next. So that night, I came home, and I was nostalgically reminiscing about the evening that had just passed, when I remembered one evening, many years before. My mother and my father and I were at a resort. I was a child, and I was sitting at a table drinking lemonade. And my parents were dancing to the music of a small orchestra, playing a waltz in a minor key. And my mother was wearing a green velvet gown, her hair flowing. And my father was very handsome. There was a cigar in his mouth, and he was flushed with excitement and love, and looked very dapper in a fancy suit with spats and a brightly colored tie. And they were dancing the waltz in this garden, with Japanese lanterns hanging and fountains, when a thunderstorm broke and everyone else left and the orchestra fled. But my mother and father continued to dance in the rain. And I sat there in the rain watching them. And it was the happiest, most memorable, and most deeply moving time in my life. It was the only time I felt truly at peace. A dream. I'm at a restaurant, sitting opposite a full-lipped, olive-skinned, lush, voluptuous woman. She looks like Lonnie Anderson, if Lonnie Anderson were Sicilian. She's talking to me, but I can't quite follow what she's saying because of the noise around us. I lean forward in order to hear better, and on a number of occasions ask her to repeat herself. She becomes impatient. She tells me she's not going to talk to me anymore because I'm not listening. I tell her I'm slightly hard of hearing from working in radio for so many years, and that I also find it hard to concentrate because she's so beautiful and has such dark, comforting eyes. We leave together in a taxi, while my girlfriend, Justine, leaves in another. I feel anxious and guilty about not being in Justine's cab. Our taxi pulls into a terminal and the driver informs us that we have to wait 10 minutes to pick up another fare, a small pony that will share the taxi with us. I can't afford to wait 10 minutes because I have to get back to Justine's, and I complain to the driver. Then, without paying him, I get out alone to hail another cab. A cab races by me, sees me waving my arm, brakes hard, spins halfway around. I see the driver is a grizzled old guy, and the cab comes back and picks me up. Then, suddenly, I'm riding in a bus, and I see the same voluptuous woman again, only now she's standing on a ladder in the street, her large breasts exposed, squirting two jets of milk from her nipples out onto the pavement. She loses her balance and falls off the ladder. Then she asks me what I think of her. I say, "You look ungainly." Many years ago in Greenwich Village, I'm about 19, in a club, when an older woman in her late 30s strikes up a conversation with me. We dance for a while. Then she says she's afraid to walk home alone, and would I accompany her? I say, okay. As we walk to her apartment, about 7 or 8 blocks away, she tells me she wants some coffee, and I suggest we stop at a cafe on the way. But she says she wants to brew it fresh at home. We arrive at her apartment. She invites me in for coffee. Then we're sitting at her dining room table drinking coffee together. When she says she has a stiff neck, and would I massage it for her, please? And I walk around behind her and begin massaging her neck. Then she suggests that it would be so much more comfortable if she lay down for the massage. And she leads me into her bedroom, where she lies down on the bed, and I continue to massage her neck. When suddenly, she reaches up, kisses me, and embraces me, and pulls me down on top of her, and starts taking off my clothes. I say, "Wait, slow down. I don't even know you." And she says, "Know me? You want to know me?" And she walks over to the mantle and lifts one photo after another, waving them at me. And she says, "This is my mother. She's insane. This is my brother. He's a lawyer. This is my father. He was shot dead in a fight with someone. This is my sister. She's a school teacher in Albany." Then she says, "My name is so-and-so. I'm 29 years old. I work at an insurance firm. I'm a bookkeeper. Okay, now you know me. You're beautiful and you're very young, but I'm not as young as you. I don't have as much time to be patient, so take off your clothes. and she starts attacking me again. And I say, listen, to tell you the truth, I don't have a condom. And she says, well, do you think I'm crazy? You think I would do something like this without a condom? I say, you have a condom? Why didn't you say so? So we spend the night together. And the next morning, I see a photograph of planet Earth on her wall. And I say, that's a beautiful photograph of the Earth. And she says, that's not the Earth. I say, sure it is. There's Africa and there's Europe. And she says angrily, it's not the Earth. Everybody thinks it's the Earth, but it's not. And I say, okay. And I get dressed and I leave. Border of Kashmir. Although it is the second highest mountain in the world, it is nevertheless the most difficult to climb because the last mile and a half consists of sheer vertical rock with sub-zero winds that are ferocious. It's a mountain that has had such a history of disasters that nobody tries to climb it anymore, and this is why I decided to attempt it. Now, the conventional approach would be to hire seasoned professional climbers sponsored by a sporting club or adventure magazine or National Geographic, the purpose being to conquer the unassailable for the sheer giddy triumph of achieving the act and take photographs and plant a flag, install a plaque. But I decided I'd be going with my friend Aaron, who's a CPA, and with an eclectic group of people consisting of a proctologist, an existential philosopher, an expert in Near Eastern affairs, a purchasing agent from a small Midwestern manufacturing concern, the principal bassoonist of the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra, and a Second Circuit judge from the state of New York, among others. No one had any mountain climbing experience, and this was very important. Now, in a conventional ascent, you're supposed to bring ropes and pulleys and crampons and hammers and mallets and cleats and tents and oxygen masks and highly sophisticated radio equipment, including GPS, which is a global positioning system which permits climbers the use of stationary satellites to coordinate their exact position by latitude and longitude, and you map out the ascent to the last detail and determine the kinds of food and medicines you'll need, and everyone is trained in first aid and in CPR, in on-site trauma treatment in case of accident, in setting of broken bones, in the application of tourniquets and compresses, even in minor surgery like stitching an open wound, cauterizing a pulsing artery. And before the ascent, you all exercise vigorously to get in shape and take a regimen of powerful vitamins, amino acids, neurotransmitters, endorphins. But we decided that this kind of behavior was beneath us. We were going to ascend the mountain in our own unique fashion. First of all, we decided not to consult any maps of K2. After all, the last thing you want in life is a map, because you see only what someone has seen before you. People are forced to use all kinds of maps to make their way in life. We're all hemmed in by maps. Too often our lives are mapped out for us. Codes, rules, regulations, precedents, preconceived notions of right and wrong pile up until, by the time you're an adult, you're just drowning in the formulas of other people's lives. So, no maps for us. We also decided to be utterly out of condition, to take up smoking, to eat a high-fat, low-carbohydrate, no-fiber diet, and to drink a lot of whiskey, single malt scotches, gin, vodka, bourbon, and sweet liqueurs. And as far as being outfitted for the climb, none of those fancy thermal outfits and goggles for us. No, we'd climb the mountain in shorts, bathroom thongs, and open-necked sports shirts. We were going to ascend K2 in a way it had never before been conquered. The style, the manner, the look, the execution, the quality of the experience would be so dramatically different as to be almost not like climbing a mountain at all, but would be an act of literary, poetic, and sociopathic trailblazing. It would make for us an anti-place in the non-history of the so-called sport of mountain climbing. And the equipment we decided to bring with us consisted of a microwave oven, a hairdryer, a pottery kick wheel, a dishwasher, some floor lamps, a bubble jet color laser printer, hair tonic, fly casting equipment, a barbecue grill with a chef's hat, mallard duck decoys. So that was all the equipment we were going to take up the side of the mountain with us, with the exception of one more item, a huge crucifix, because I thought it would be a good shape to introduce at high altitudes. I was just pleased with the concept of dragging an enormous cross up K2. It was appealing, it had a certain resonance for me, and I thought it should be extremely heavy, made of teak, and studded with nails. And we decided that everyone had to wear a Mardi Gras mask, because it's fun to wear masks when you're taking a long trip. It serves to pass the time, and we also hired a marching band to accompany us with drum majorettes, a parade marshal. The advantage of having a marching band when you're going up a steep climb is that it gives you a beat to which you can set your pace. It buoys your spirit. There's nothing like marching band music to maintain the morale of the group. It energizes you, and the drum majorettes add a certain flair and excitement, wearing their short, pleated skirts, their polyvinyl chloride white 1960s style boots, their tank tops, and visored caps. Now, the initial problem you confront with K2 is simply getting there. First, you have to cross a huge salt lake by the Afghani highlands near the city of Balkh. And we made the voyage in an old World War I vintage African Queen riverboat with no engine, entirely wind-powered. And in order to make the trip even more challenging, halfway across the lake, we agreed to get dead drunk, take LSD, and then pour kerosene all over the decks and set fire to the boat to see what would happen. We wanted to set up challenges, challenges that people in other situations might find insurmountable. We were going to create them in order to intensify the metaphor of our journey. And so we had a prodigiously psychedelic experience, which was transcendental, intense, brilliant, insightful, profound. A passage beyond death where deceased family members, departed statesmen, deities, talking fish, animated weather fronts would carry on lively conversations with us and with each other. And the lake turned into the great boiling open mouth of a huge soprano. And later, when we woke up, we were cast on the opposite shore, our clothes shredded, our bodies battered, bruised, some of us impaled on tree branches, others with voracious fish clamped onto their arms and legs. One man was fornicating with an octopus. And those who didn't make it were forever enshrined in the memories and internal histories of those who carried on the standard of the expedition. And the LSD had an interesting effect on us. What happened is that the boundaries between individuals became porous, and personalities were now flowing across borders, so that the individuation of each member of the expedition was becoming less well-defined. We were all flowing into one entity, a single being that consisted not of individual members of an ascent team, but of one great, uniformly unicellular being, one organism. Without an ego, you felt you were part of the larger scheme of things, and you experienced an exhilarating sense of oneness with the universe. Without ego, there is no angst, no jealousy, no self-hatred, no self-doubt, no longing, no regret, no sense of loss, no wish to gain, no greed, no striving, no ambition. We have everything that the Buddha rejected. But then there was this nagging doubt about who you were, and this sense that you were suffering from amnesia. And so you desperately wanted to find your way back to yourself, to your storehouse of memories, to the compass that pointed towards your individuality, the set of coordinates unique to yourself, the crossing of the longitude and latitude lines that defined who you were, that place on the map called home, that had your name on it, that was the most familiar place in the world. So sitting around that fire, moving back and forth from oneness with the universe to our own personal lives, was a very strange and unique experience. Because your sense of yourself and your place in the universe kept shifting with the ever-changing tides of consciousness that was the hallmark of the experience. But finally, the LSD wore off. And then we began the second leg of our journey. A 150-mile stretch of road made of red clay, which, when baked in the sun, produced a choking cloud of airborne dust stirred by hot winds. The roadside was alive with scorpions and venomous desert snakes. And there was an occasional orange stand that sold watermelons, tangerine slices, cold beer, and cigarettes. And once, we passed a pair of elderly men engaged in a silent, slow-motion chess game, an hourglass on the table before them. And at their feet, there was a birdcage containing a dwarf who was gripping the bars in his fingers, sullenly staring at us, and urinating into a small pan at the bottom of the cage, which was filled with shredded paper. After this, we had to forge a huge whitewater river. So we strung a rope across and tied it to two trees on opposite sides of the river, and we individually tried to make it across. And the river, being in a valley, was whipped white with powerful gusts of wind that descended off the sides of the mountains. The water raced by as though drawn by some irresistible force. And in the turbulent, raging river below, we saw overturned boats, the remnants of bridges that had been swept away, huge advertising billboards, satellite dishes, and what appeared to be the smokestack of an ocean liner. And some of our members were blown from the bridge into the water and dashed against the rocks that formed the course through which the river ran. And so we lost a few drum majorettes, and the tuba player was swept away screaming, grasping ineffectually at the moss-slick boulders. So we barely got to the other side and held a small service for those who didn't make it. We lit incense, roasted a chicken, had the marching band play Nearer My God to Thee and Amazing Grace. And we carved the names of the deceased into the wooden sides of a miniature cathedral we'd built, and then we set the cathedral afire so that the smoke would reach the heavenly precincts and remain forever part of the Earth's atmosphere. And then we moved on to what appeared to be an impenetrable jungle, alive with carnivorous plants which at night would send poisonous shoots and tendrils down to strangle you and insert sucker buds through your skin and into your muscles and begin to drain the blood and fluid from your body. And we were there on purpose during the monsoon season because we were trying to make the trek as difficult and memorable and challenging as possible. And so we were deluged for 45 days with continual rain. And nothing could be kept dry, so food would rot, and there were digestive disorders and lots of diarrhea, and people were suffering from dehydration. And we celebrated this because it was the most awful, the most horrendous, the most punishing experience of our lives. And by virtue of that, we felt triumphant. We next had to pass through a decayed third world urban landscape with burnt out buildings and smoldering wrecks of automobiles and bands of drunken teenage boys driving armored personnel carriers through the streets, firing recoilless rifles, and gangs run by local warlords with rocket-propelled grenade launchers and AK-47s. And there were huge crowds of refugees carrying all their worldly belongings in shopping carts and in pillowcases, women with baskets on their heads. And there were prostitutes and maimed beggars and naked children playing in polluted pools of filthy water and old men with begging bowls. And the gangs of the different warlords would demand tribute, and we gave them all of our belongings. And the squalor was breathtaking, exquisite, pandemic, universal, overwhelming. And we were exhilarated by the pain and suffering that we saw. Every time we were robbed, we felt a sense of, yes, this is what it's about. This is life. This is the real thing. This is not like the life we led back in the United States, that bourgeois, boring, predictable, coddled, pampered existence. Even when members of our party were summarily executed or shot down by drunken soldiers, we felt that our purpose was achieved. These were the richest experiences. We knew that when these things happened, that we would never forget them. This would be the high point of our lives. And when one of our comrades was taken blindfolded, hung upside down from a tree, beaten with rubber truncheons, shot, and then set aflame, we thought, it doesn't get any better than this. We felt as if we were on a euphoric drug, our hearts full, our souls as though for the first time, alive. But by the time we made it to the base of K2, most of us were so ill and so exhausted that we could hardly stand up. So we never made the attempt to climb it. And I found it very interesting and quite compelling that the entire enterprise had involved exclusively getting to the mountain, but not actually climbing it. And from this, we inferred that the lesson to be learned might be that the actual doing of something is not as important as preparing to do it. So the act itself is really unnecessary. It really has no meaning. It's an afterthought. What really matters is approaching the challenge. To then actually engage the experience is really a waste of your time, when you could be spending that time facing new risks. In other words, once we had finally arrived at the mountain, climbing it became irrelevant, because we had already, in a sense, climbed it. Through the difficulty and obstacles and suffering we'd experienced, we had already become it. We knew it. We'd experienced it. And so we considered the expedition a success, and we meet every year on that date and throw a big party at which we show slides and tell stories about everything we did leading up to the climb that we never made. And in retrospect, I think we all agree that it was one of the most gratifying and fulfilling experiences of our lives, because we considered the event an ascent, albeit a horizontal ascent. Horizontal or vertical, it didn't really matter. That seemed a minor distinction. And we're still angry that the Academy did not accept our claim that we actually reached the top of K2, because we felt that we had ascended it without actually ascending it. We had ascended it in the sense that we had risen above the concept of ascension. This is Joe Frank. You've been listening to Somewhere Out There. This program was created in collaboration with Arthur Miller and David Rapkin. Recorded, edited, mixed, and music looping by Bob Carlson. With special guests, vocalist Judith Owen and sax player David Brown. Thanks also to Jennifer Farrow, Carly Eisman, and Esme Gregson. Somewhere Out There will return next week at the same time.